Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Film Baby Film, the podcast for people who love movies, or films if you're being pretentious. I'm your host, John Lobinger, and I'm joined today by Jordan Esso. And we're going to be discussing, this is part two in a two-part series. Actually, I think it's, I don't know how you want to measure it. It's definitely the second part of our series on Paul Thomas Anderson. We're going to discuss There Will Be Blood as well as The Master. We had a previous episode where we discussed Magnolia and Punch Drunk Love and Inherent Vice. This is the second part of that first conversation. We also had a conversation later on Phantom Thread, and so that episode will be forthcoming. Jordan and I are also in conversations about sometime in March wrapping up all of PTA's work. So going back and doing Heartache, Boogie Nights, but also getting into some of the music videos and his documentary. I think it's called Junjun. I don't know. I don't even remember the name of it. That's how little I know about it. But so I'm very excited to share this with you. Had a lot going on the past few weeks, so I was planning on getting out this episode earlier, but was fortunate enough to do some really terrific traveling. Went to Nicaragua to visit a friend who is has a foundation or charity out there where they help support education in the coffee farm areas of Nicaragua, areas sorely in need of these types of services. And it was just an amazing experience. Then I also got to go to Sundance. And Sundance, I'm gonna have an episode where we discuss the films that I saw there. Actually, I'm also going to have an episode connected to Nicaragua. At some point, I'm gonna have my friend Kristen Van Busum on to discuss Walker, which is a film in the Criterion Collection. And is also based on events that happened in Nicaragua, or at least a man that would have play a prominent role in Nicaraguan history. Also going to do a Sundance episode, but before that, you guys will get to hear my discussion with Jordan Esso on Phantom Thread. So that's almost, you might think of that as like part three of the PTA series. But then also going to release a top 10 episode that we have that I did with DJ Moore. A really terrific guy, terrific discussion. We had him on previously, and I know it's getting a little bit late for the 2010, for the top 10 of 2017 episode. But there you go. So without further ado, Jordan Esso, he's still the man. Paul Thomas Anderson, part two, Film Baby Film. Let's do it. Awesome. And then, yeah, let's just go in and do the clap thing.
Sure.
So I'll do six claps and you jump in on four, five, and six, okay?
Nice.
One, two, three, four
five, six.
Awesome. Oh, man. So I have to tell you, I kind of assumed that this was going to go this way. I'm really grateful that you are doing this episode with me. So some of my friends, when I invite them on the podcast, they're now like, oh man, does this mean I have to do homework? And I didn't intend, like, I don't intend to give people a ton of homework. I just get really excited and like want to do all this stuff. And mostly I get excited and I want to have like a good conversation about movies. And so I'm like, yeah, let's talk about blah, blah, blah. And then when I get around to actually doing it, I'm like, holy shit, I have to watch all five of these movies and then write all these notes or whatever. So,
and they're dense movies. It's not like they're real obvious about the way they do things.
And not just dense, heavy as well. Yeah. As I said, I'm watching some of these movies. I was like, oh man, like this is some heavy stuff that we're dealing with here. So,
but it's such a great excuse. Like, I'm really glad that the episode evolved this way, because I never would have taken on like rewatching all of these films in such a short span and thinking deeply about them. So this has been a real privilege.
When was the last time you saw There Will Be Blood? before you rewatched it for this. I'm assuming you rewatched it recently.
I did, yeah. Uh-huh. I saw it last week. I saw it when it came out and was a little bit, like I already shared with you, a little bit disappointed that it wasn't sort of the same cloth. And then I've seen, I think I saw it one time in between. So that was the third time I saw it. Yeah.
Okay. And so tell me how your, you had already mentioned that your, you liked the movie the first time you saw it, but you were disappointed because I think as a lot of viewers probably had their reaction when they saw Darren Aronofsky's latest movie, Mother. It wasn't the drug that they intended to buy.
Yeah. Now, I haven't seen Mother yet. I'll let you know that right now. I haven't watched it yet.
I'm not going to spoil that for you. That's not my point. I'm thinking more just along the lines of this is the type of movie where if you went into it expecting Magnolia, you just didn't get that. You didn't get Magnolia. You got something totally different than PTA had ever done before.
Yeah, I mean, it's the trap of, you know, there are no second acts in literature, in American literature, because, like, it's what a trap to have to, like, emulate yourself in order to, like, participate in the branding that you accidentally created. So it's tough, you know? I mean, people's styles are a product of their instincts, but instincts mature and they change, or sometimes I think creators, we just feel like we've done that in the best way or most satisfying way, and that changes your priorities. So I'm all for, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson making whatever film he wants to. But I became a fan because of Magnolia and then Boogie Nights and then Punch Drunk Love. So I was looking for that similar thing. And this felt quite different.
And yeah, and it was quite different. And so what was your experience viewing it most recently? What is your reaction to this film? How much do you like it? Like what's your latest take on it?
Well, I'm going to save the ranking right till the end, but
yeah,
I will say I love it. I want to see it again, kind of sooner than later. I, for the first time, realized it was a horror story, you know, and I never thought of it that way before. I never thought of it as like a story about a haunted landscape and the person that is both haunted by it and haunts it. And that was my freshest take on it this time around. So that kind of excited me to think of it that way. Daniel Plainview is a very different character than we've seen from this filmmaker before. And I think understanding how I feel about him is a journey I'm still going on, because sometimes I think, well, shit, he gets kind of a bad rap. You know, there's, look at this humanity he has here. And then he does these really awful things that I know he's going to do. But, you know, when he betrays the people around him, sometimes you feel like you know how that happened, and then other times it is shockingly malicious.
So, yeah, it's interesting that you didn't pick up on the horror of the film until this most recent viewing. It was the thing that jumped out at me the first time I watched it, and I didn't like it the first time I watched it. I think, as I had said in the previous conversation, and I like it a lot better now that I've seen it. But one thing that I definitely got for sure the first time was, this is supposed to be hellish. This is supposed to be a little bit about a man who I think you're supposed to like him somewhat, but at the same time, you also totally understand his descent into madness, his descent into hell, at the same time.
Yeah, and so yet, I mean, he's pursuing
I got that from
hell.
The beginning.
He's looking for it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But I mean, like, I understood it was horrific. But what I mean by, I think of it as a horror story now, like, I almost think of it as a genre film. Like, there is something, you know, like Night of the Hunter. He feels so much like, you know, like Reverend Harry Powell when he's stalking outside the bandy tract home. Like, so when he's on horse there and he's sort of peeking through the various doorways and windows like that, I'm like, God, this is like Night of the Hunter. This is like a genre film. This is and on some level, this is a genre exercise. And I never did think of it that way. But I didn't used to think about horror films very deeply. I did a horror film very recently, and I did a lot of, as I'm sure you can expect, like I studied the genre before doing that film and developed a healthy respect for the genre that I didn't have before. So now I think of horror films differently. I think before, if I said, oh, this is a horror movie, I think I would have felt like I was cheapening it by saying that. Now I don't feel that way. Like, just like any genre, there are cheap examples and exemplary profound examples. I would say this is a profound horror film.
That's really interesting. Did you, during any of your viewings, pay close attention to some of the... So, just as a... I guess we should set the stage here a little bit. So, this is a movie that came out of an Upton Sinclair book called Oil! Exclamation point. So, I guess that's another connection that it has to Mother. Oil! Exclamation point. And it was... And it was a movie that was also inspired by... It's a bit of a California movie. It's a bit of a movie about a guy who has an obsession and pursues that obsession. And Daniel Day-Lewis won an Academy Award for Best Actor, as well as Elswit, the cinematographer, won his Academy Award for this film as well. Very well regarded film, and it follows Daniel Day-Lewis's character Daniel Plainview as he goes from being a silver miner to being an oil man, and it describes his familial relationships. And here again, we have a situation where not only are his relationships dysfunctional, but while they're family relationships, and they truly are family relationships, they're also in a certain level not. Like, they're not actually... He has a couple of family members, quote-unquote family members in the movie, that actually are not his real family.
Yeah.
But as he goes deeper and deeper into his obsession and his ambition, he also is alternating between reaching out to others and pushing others away in the most brutal way that he can find possible.
Yeah, and he has a pretty decent explanation of his inner psychology, unlike other Paul Thomas Anderson characters who are not that introspective or not that curious or knowledgeable about themselves. He seems to understand himself pretty well when he talks about himself to Henry, who is one of his false brothers in the film. You know, he talks about how misanthropic he feels and how competitive he feels. And he is sharing this not to brag. I think he really is trying to share something of himself to connect with Henry, who at this point he believes is his brother. And so he says, if it's in me, it's in you. Like, he's trying to create some familiar bond there by sharing this thing about himself.
Do you think that, so one of the questions in this movie, and there are a bunch of questions. One of the questions in this movie is Daniel Plainview obsessive because he's misanthropic and alienated, or is he alienated and misanthropic because of his obsession? Like, there's a certain question of is it the chicken, what came first, the chicken or the egg, or is it just that they're both this mutually reinforcing behaviors inside of him? So just thinking of his psychology, like, why is he the way he is something I'm always wondering when I watch this movie.
I think mutually reinforcing is a great way to put it. It's easy in the context of this show that we're doing right now to continually compare, you know, one piece of one film to another. So I'll continue the trend. Dirk Diggler, while that is a much more wholesome character, is one driven by ambition, a kind of naked ambition, no pun intended, that gets galvanized by success. You know, he goes off the rails because he is successful, and because then the desire to continue to become more successful than he was the day before, to call more shots than he was in charge before, to, you know, seize even more control of his environment and his destiny, it almost destroys him. And I think Daniel Plainview has a similar kind of trajectory where he's a ambitious person by nature, and he's somebody who wants to carve out his own identity. And when he finds that he can seize that power and that he can carve out results that, you know, dramatically change not only, you know, his living standard, but the amount of people that look up to him and follow his orders, he can't stop. It's a goal to continue to fulfill this fantasy he has about himself as unstoppable.
It's really interesting because one of the crucial things that he does to, you know, to sort of reveal his character is when he's selling to the different towns that he goes to, Little Boston in particular, but he does it a couple of times where he says, look, if you allow me to come in and drill oil here, I will invest in roads, I'll invest in schools, I'll invest in the families and the community and all this other stuff. Part of it is clearly he's a huckster and he's just trying to make a buck, and so he's going to tell people whatever he thinks they want to hear. But I think there's also a part of him that that's genuine in him. I think he genuinely wants to be a community leader. He genuinely wants to contribute to the public welfare. But he begins to get further and further away from that. And it's kind of amazing to watch his I don't know if it's backsliding, but to watch his downfall.
It's an interesting question. Like, I don't want to split hairs with what you just said, but you know, if he believes it, like, then I become really curious. Is it one of those things where you justify your behavior in the most benevolent means possible, where you understand that these manipulations are, if not coming from a selfish place, they at least, you know, aid in these selfish missions that you have set out for yourself. So if he is basically creating upward mobility through the manipulation of other people around him, but part of that agenda ends up kind of maybe benefiting the community anyway, he might, sell himself on the speech of that I believe in children, and I believe in education, and I believe in, you know, in bringing crops here that you can be self-sustaining. Like, maybe he's not indifferent to that, but I guess I hesitate to feel that that's at all a driving force for him.
Sure. In other words, he doesn't mind. He doesn't mind if he can benefit others, but that's not really why he's doing it. He's saying those things just to get in, get the oil, and then, you know, whether or not he actually delivers on those promises, I guess, matters less to him, is what you're suggesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Paul Dano. Now, part of the great thing about this movie is that having Eli and Paul Sunday being played by Paul Dano, it makes me like Daniel Plainview a lot more, because it's just so easy to hate that face. Like, it's so easy to hate Paul Dano whenever he shows up in a movie. And when Daniel Plainview does these, you know, when he's sort of wrestling, I think my interpretation of the character is that there's a real genuine human inside of Daniel Plainview. And like a guy with real feelings and real questioning about humanity's place in the universe, right? But he gets to really, like, externalize his anger. I don't know if it's anger at God, if it's anger at other humans, or maybe particularly other humans that try to manipulate his own confusion about life and about his place in the universe. But there's a part of him that just gets to externalize all of his rage in such a focused and naked way whenever Paul Dano shows up. And I just love it. And I just want him to baptize that man in mud as often as humanly possible. It's one of the great enjoyments of this movie, is just like celebrating when Daniel Plainview does these awful things, as long as it's Paul Dano on the receiving end.
Well, you know, his face could be described as punchable, but it also could be described as cherubic. And I do think that that is so... what is so satisfying about casting him in this part is that there's a quality about him that seems like he's lying to you no matter what he's saying. And that's where his face becomes sort of sinister, and where, like, you might feel like unexplainable aggression towards Eli. But he's also got this beautiful, sweet face. I mean, his face belongs in a Renaissance painting when it's lit the right way. Right. And you know, his last name Sunday, you know, the snake oil he's selling is the Church of the Third Revelation. And I'm not always entirely clear what Eli believes in terms of his faith, but you know, the sweetness in his face, the natural sort of wholesome sweetness, is a beautiful compliment to the landscape, certainly to Daniel Plainview's face. I can see why some of his followers would follow him. There's a way in which you can see Paul Dano in this landscape as looking almost like a divine presence.
So going back to a little bit of the psychology of Daniel Plainview, so he, part of the way that he sells himself in this movie is he adopts a young boy. Early in the movie, it's essentially a silent film for the first 15 minutes. Daniel Plainview falls down one of his mines and looks like he broke his leg, looks like he almost crippled himself. And this is a continuation, like this is a continuing theme in the movie, is that Daniel Plainview has several brushes with death. One of those brushes with death is really sort of a haunting thing to think about if you think about it from being in that perspective yourself, is he's down in an oil well with another guy, and the guy right next to him gets killed.
Yeah.
And that guy right next to him has a son that's up on land. Daniel Plainview adopts him. And there's been some discussion, or I've had discussions with other people. Is this a sign of his humanity that he adopts that boy? Is it a sign of his naked ambition that he's, right off the bat thinking, oh, I can manipulate adopting this child to further my own ends and make more inroads in communities when I'm trying to drill oil there? Or is this another one of those, you can't really separate the two, they're connected?
What do you think?
I think actually it's a sign of his humanity. I think it's a sign of his humanity. I think he genuinely feels empathy. I think he was scarred the first time that he fell down a mine, and then I think he was particularly scarred when that guy next to him almost died, and I think he adopted HW. It's HW, right? That's the name of the son?
Yeah.
I think he adopts HW for genuine love.
I agree with you that this is a very natural act that he does when he takes this child on. I have a couple problems with the idea that he's doing this in order to stage some like future manipulation of some future community. First of all, he doesn't know his destiny quite yet. He does improvise. He figures that out as he goes along. And you have to imagine, I mean, I'm not a historian, but you know, children mostly did not survive. So counting on the fact that if he rescues an abandoned baby on the side of this dig, that he's going to be able to make sure that he's still around when he's cute enough to help, you know, lubricate a handshake, I doubt it. You know, most likely this kid's not going to survive because most likely they did not. I think he did the right thing because it's an instinctual human thing to, I mean, what was the alternative? To throw him down the well? To smother his face in a bed of dust? Like, I think he just did the natural thing. And later, it became a convenience for some of these negotiations.
So what's interesting, and I think we'll talk about Henry next. So on the one hand, I think it's very clear that Daniel Plainview wants a family. I think his adoption of the child is complicated, but I think it's not complicated by his ambition. I think it's complicated because I think Daniel Plainview really wants emotional connections, but I think he wants emotional connections that he can control, and if he really needs to, that he can abandon. And I think that having this surrogate son, having this adopted son, I think he genuinely really wants a child, but I also think he wants the ability to walk away if he needs to. So I think this is like perfect for him.
Yeah. Right. Cause it's his, but it's not his.
Yes, exactly.
What more could he possibly owe to this adopted child? He's already saved its life. Like, does he really owe it everything forever? Like, it should owe him something, I think, is the position he arrives at.
And why I think this is particularly relevant to him is because think about I love the conversation with Henry that he has when he says, Henry, I don't need to look past people's faults in order to get what I need from them. And what I think he's saying at that moment is essentially, hey, buddy, I know you're a fraud. I know you're not my brother, but we're going to play this as long as I want to play this. Because I want somebody, I want a partner. I've already, because at that point, I think he had already, oh no, he hadn't yet. Sorry. He hadn't sent HW away, but I think he was already starting to think about it. But I know that he wanted a partner, wanted somebody to work with. He gets this brother, and I think he knew Henry was a fraud from the jump.
That's interesting. Yeah, not sure. I'm willing to be convinced, though. I'm not sure what he thinks about Henry. I agree that he's looking for someone to control. I agree that he's definitely suspicious and not completely sold on it. But, you know, when we talk about Daniel's humanity and the urges within him that we can relate to for companionship, I wonder to what extent that does it, at least temporarily, drive him to buy it.
And then, so getting away, I think, a little bit from Daniel Plainview's psychology, one of the things that I really like about this movie is that it has so many different layers of interpretation. And all of them are things that I think add to the movie rather than detract. One of the things that I think about in this movie is obviously the drive to create. I can't help but look at Daniel Plainview and think, this is what some directors must feel like when they're directing a film. They just think, you know, I'm hell-bent. I'm going to make this movie at all costs, no matter what it costs me in terms of my personal relationships, whatever. And I'm just going to use everybody. I don't know. Did you get any sense that this was a part of the, this was like symbolic of the act of creation, his desire to drill for oil?
It's interesting. I thought about the earth as, you know, some kind of vessel of creation, but in terms of thinking it as a parallel for a film director, it had not occurred to me. I think that's a very interesting reading of it.
I think that this is obviously a movie that asks you to, you know, invites you to look at it for other layers of meaning. What are some of the things that jumped out at you in terms of readings of this film?
Well, I'm really very interested in the false prophet elements of the story. Like we already talked about that, you know, there's a lot of scam artists and snake oil salesmen in this body of work. But this one is even more complicated because of the false relationship to the son. Like the son doesn't know that he's adopted. Henry pretends to be his brother. Paul pretends to be his friend. Eventually by marriage is his brother of sorts. And so there's a lot of like fake family connections where, you know, in previous films we're being told that people are connected through similar behaviors or through circumstantial interactions. And here, you know, Daniel keeps getting sold this idea that he has a family and that it is a direct byproduct of his sense of industry and his sense of capitalism, that it is one of the, you know, natural things that he is generating when he goes out and rapes the land for the oil, which I do see as blood, a system of the earth's blood, which is part of like this new take I have on it being a horror film, that when, you know, they strike oil and it shoots out of the earth like a geyser and it rains, like it feels like it's raining blood and that there's something horrific happening to the earth. And he takes pleasure in that, you know, that sense of domination. So the politics of domination, of false prophets, but also false family, it's all part of that fabric of madness where, when you say we can maybe understand how this downward spiral happens to Daniel Plainview, yeah, I think we can understand that that atmosphere was probably maddening, would probably turn anyone into a kind of a narcissistic monster.
And I think, so the first take on it with regards to the false prophet is, I think that you see on several occasions Daniel Plainview is genuinely curious about his place in the universe. He sees people die. on a number of occasions, or somebody dies like while he's sleeping, and he is curious about man's place in the universe. And when he reaches out, who's there for him other than the most false, the most patently false prophet, Paul Sunday? And so the rage of a man who's, you know, who's so focused, and then takes a step back and something happens, his adopted son gets injured, or, you know, one of his workers dies, and he says, you know, I'm curious, I want to see what's, you know, is there something to this? Is there something to this God concept? Goes to church, and it's a total fraud. The kind of rage that would generate in a man like Daniel Plainview, like, oh, I've been had, you know, my weakness has got me again. I can only imagine. And that's one of the exciting things that I saw in this movie, this most recent viewing.
Do you read like I do that when Daniel's forced to go to the Church of the Third Revelation and be baptized in order to make the deal for the Bandy Tract? Do you think, oh, no, that's not for the Bandy Tract, right? It's for that other piece of land. But he's forced to do that in order to capitulate to the wishes of the owner of that land, to join the church and be baptized. And he has to recite this thing that Paul Sunday has designed for him to say, I'm sorry, Eli Sunday has designed for him to say, he's abandoned his child, that he actually has a cathartic confession there somewhere in the middle between rolling his eyes and then saying, we got a deal. When he says, I abandon my boy, I mean, it almost brings me to tears because I believe in that regret.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's both simultaneously, and that must be maddening to a man who wants as much control and power over the world as Daniel Plainview does. This guy brings out of him almost like a gusher out of Daniel, an emotional gusher of oil out of Daniel Plainview. He knows that Eli Sunday is manipulating him, but he can't help but have it as a confession. It's genuine. Yeah. He genuinely is filled with shame and rage of the way he's treated the people around him. But right. he's brought to this moment by the worst. You know, for a misanthropic person to be confronted with Eli Sunday, he's the justification for all of your rage against other humans. Like, he's a total, he's an awful human, manipulating people's weaknesses and their desires to be, you know, connected to God. And so Daniel Plainview must be especially enraged that's the moment where he has catharsis is from from Eli Sunday.
Right, because if Daniel hates that quality about himself at all, when game recognizes game, that it's, you know, that's when you really find rage, you know, because you know what they're up to, and that it works on you just like your fucking tricks work on other people, and that he's able to elicit genuine emotion and genuine transformation in those other people that he's lying to. Like, yeah, I think that's when some real rage gets seated.
One of the things, so going back to Daniel Plainview's psychology here a little bit, when he reaches the culmination of his dreams, right? So what happens is the Bandy Tract, it was to get access to the Bandy Tract, but it wasn't to get access to the drilling rights, because the band, William Bandy, I think his name was, he didn't want there to be any oil derricks on his land. But what Daniel Plainview wanted was the ability to ship oil without having to pay railroad freight costs. So instead, he creates a pipeline that reaches the ocean, reaches the Pacific. And right. So in order to do that, he needs to go over the Bandy Tract. And he gets the rights to install like an 8-inch wide pipe through the land, and it reaches the ocean. And we have been living in a land of black and red and brown. And suddenly we're introduced to the sea, and and Daniel Plainview and his brother Henry go swimming by themselves, and it's almost like a baptism for him. And it is at that moment that Daniel Plainview fully consciously recognizes that his brother has betrayed him. His false brother is a false brother.
Yeah.
And it is at this moment of his greatest success when he now realizes this entire scheme has paid off. And by the way, the first time I watched this movie, I was in suspense on whether or not Daniel Plainview was going to succeed. So when he reaches the ocean and he finally achieves his success, it's like it's a genuine success. It is also his genuine downfall. It is the moment where he passes that threshold of he's no longer going to be able to retrieve his humanity, because he realizes his brother is a false brother. And instead of recognizing him as a fellow human and being like, okay, you betrayed me, get out of here, he is filled with resentment and murderous rage.
Yeah.
And I think it's amazing that it is like height of success, diving into the ocean, completely baptized and like born anew, that is the moment when he decides, screw it. I want nothing to do with anybody.
Yeah, no, I think that's a beautiful comparison, that his actual baptism is a really beautiful point. I would say, you know, in either reading, when he murders Henry, either reading is possible when he finds out for sure, because Henry admits it, when he can't produce, you know, the information that would verify that he was actually there. And he falls into a rage. That rage could be, I now know for sure that you're a liar, and that makes me feel like a fool, and I'm going to punish you for that. Or, I've been playing along to get what I can get from you, but now that you've had the embarrassment to confess it to me, I can no longer pretend, which means that if I don't hurt you now, then I'll be a fool.
Right. Right.
But it's interesting to think about this moment of violence versus the violence at the end of the film, because they do feel very different.
Very different. So I'll say one of the other readings that it's easy to have about this movie is the biblical allusions that are present here. There are a ton of them. The Esau and Jacob story about a son stealing the other son's birthright is one of the most profound stories in the Bible for me, and was something I remember. I remember the first time I heard it as like a 5-year-old. And so the fact that that's in this movie has always been deeply profound. It was the first time I watched it, I thought of it, but was especially effective the second time.
Interesting.
One of the other things that's amazing is that, like, the concept of hell. There is so much hell in this movie. You almost wonder if Daniel Plainview is a form of a satanic character, that he's so hell bent. You know, he's like this capitalist urge. There's that, but it's also like he wants the hellfire. He wants the sulfur, the brimstone. Like, he wants to bring fire and the blackness out of the earth. And that was something I really got this most recent viewing.
Well, yeah, doesn't he? He really gets off on saying, I'm the only one who can drill it. You know, yeah. I'm the one who can do it. So the more chaotic and dangerous he can make the environment, but still claim himself to be the only one who can harness that, that's quite an ego trip. And it makes
the,
him.
What about the crushing blacks that you referenced? We're talking about Punch Drunk Love. I mean, the blacks in this are insane.
Yeah, I think that the particular thing about the high contrast, crushed blacks and clipped whites, that's pretty consistent, I think, for most of the films. And it's definitely true here. You still see some of the some of that cobalt blue banding and lens flare that he did, you know, and I wouldn't say every scene, but consistently in Punch Drunk Love, that shows up here at times. You can still see that color palette happening. And I'm wondering sometimes, you know, the interior scenes on this film, There Will Be Blood, feel very different than the exterior scenes. The exterior scenes often feel almost overexposed. There's a lot of white. There's not a lot of harmony in the color palette. It's like the opposite of Punch Drunk Love, where it was very specific about what colors were going to be involved in the set dressing and the color grading. Here, it feels almost to me, documentary in its approach to the exterior scenes, which I think participates in my sense that this doesn't feel like a history film. You know, there's a lot of films that take place in the past that insist upon, you know, the kind of maybe sepia tone or the, you know, like super indulgence in things that suggest like history. This film doesn't do that. Like the costumes are period accurate without being like in your face about it. And I feel like how naturalistic everything looks outside makes this film feel very present and not sort of an indulgent exercise in making a, you know, a history feature. But the interior scenes feel, I mean, and this is again, like respectful of the kind of lighting that you'd have then. It would be that sort of that ochre incandescent, you know, yellow lighting, but those scenes feel much more harmonious and much more comforting. And I'm sorry if I'm going on about this too long, but I thought about this a lot. The outdoors as a threatening environment in this film in particular, like how blindingly bright that light is, I think is part of that. Like the cocooned spaces inside the mines and the cocooned spaces, you know, inside the structures, especially at night, like there's something more controllable and comforting about those environments, and the color palette reinforces that. And then once it's day and you're outside, like it does feel like anything could happen. And it does feel like there's not a lot of attention paid to, let's make sure that we control the landscape in the same way that Daniel Plainview wants to.
Now, do you think that's because we're supposed to view the landscape as threatening, or do you think it's because man is threatening to the landscape? In other words, do you think part of the horror of this movie is like an environmental horror film? Like you watch this oil, like at one point I think they're just shoveling oil into like a hole in the ground that they've made. I mean, it's really, you can tell like this is, and then when they're burning oil at one point, there's just billows of black smoke, and you can just tell like what they're doing to the land is not going to be good for the environment. Do you feel like that's part of the horror of the movie?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't go so far to say that that's a message we should take from it, that it's supposed to make us feel like we should do something to, you know, preserve the land. I don't think it's going that far polemically. But yeah, I mean, I think it's really easy to read, like I said, the oil is blood and the chaos that Daniel Plainview insists on. I mean, I think it needs to feel violent, even when it's just digging a hole. Like he's interested in violence, and it's very obvious in how much pleasure he gets out of that sequence when the oil shoots up in that impressive geyser. You know, who cares that my son has been, you know, wounded for life? When that thing sets on fire and everything has gone literally to hell, I mean, you got that throbbing beat of the soundtrack and that pulsing firelight on Daniel's face, and he's having a good time. He's not really worried about what's happening. He's really indulging in the moment.
I think he says at one point to his partner, he says, "Why do you look so glum? We are sitting on an ocean of oil," right as his son has just been, like you said, injured permanently. It's my favorite scene in the movie. Is this your favorite scene in the movie, or is there something else that jumps out at you?
I mean, it's hard to pick a better sequence than that. It's
I mean, just God. In general, it's kind of hard to pick a better. And there's also a part of me that looks at that and says, that's definitely not CGI. That's an amazing. And I don't know if it's CGI. Maybe it is. And maybe I'm just clueless. But I look at that and I just think, how on earth did they do that? That's beautiful. And also,
I don't know.
It's amazing filmmaking.
Yeah, you can't tell if the groaning is part of the soundtrack or if it's the burning structure or if it's the people. Like there's there's a real, I mean, for as restrained as a lot of the other sequences are, like here you finally just like you, Paul Thomas Anderson and his set designer and the cinematographer just like then let go. And like it's like the big number in the concert set. Like they just gave it every ounce of power that they had now was unleashed because the color design suddenly, you know, with those deep reds and the darkening sky, like it is so freaking impressive.
And there's one shot, I think I'm remembering this correctly, where you see Daniel Day-Lewis's face, but he's covered in oil, and it's all black behind him. It's that crushing black that you're describing, and it looks like all you see is fire and black, and it's kind of amazing. It's definitely my favorite sequence in the film.
Yeah, you get the feeling that the more dangerous that it gets, not only does Daniel get off on creating that chaos, but like every time that he has a near-death experience, like it just proves, you know, how indelible he is, like how strong he is and how like irresistible a presence he is in this world. Like he's the one who doesn't get hit by the falling object. He's the one who doesn't lose their hearing in the accident. Like he survives. It's this ongoing proof that he's special and he's singular. And that is the American dream. I mean, let's face it. Like we don't play team sports without singling out someone to be the, you know, the figure who represents everyone else's effort,
the captain or the quarterback or whatever,
right? Yeah,
interesting. So I'm tempted to leave There Will Be Blood unless you really want to talk about the ending, because there's a part of me that feels like everybody focuses on the ending of the movie because it's so over the top, whereas I think it's been talked about enough and people have seen it or whatever. And I just think the rest of the movie is so wonderful. I'd be fine leaving off here and jumping over
John,
to the master.
John, we owe it to the people, John, to say a few words.
I mean, that it's interesting because so much of the film feels contained and particular and specific. And then you get to this wild anarchy at the end of the movie. It's a bit of madness. Daniel Day-Lewis, Daniel Plainview is, you know, wildly successful, ends up, they jump ahead, I think, like 15 years. He's extremely wealthy, and he's completely dived into a paranoid alcoholism. And he alienates his only son, who still loves him. Not his only son, but he alienates his adopted son, who still loves him.
You mean the bastard in the basket?
Gosh. I can't. That was so harsh to me, even though I know, you know, it's Daniel Day-Lewis sort of chewing up scenery during the film. It's so hurtful, and it's just so cruel in a way that, like, him killing somebody didn't feel as cruel as him saying that phrase over and over, even though his son is deaf. And even though he's out of earshot, like, his translator isn't translating anymore. He just keeps on yelling it.
Yeah. Well, he's taking advantage of the fact it's kind of like, you know, one of the best things that ever happened to his son was he didn't have to hear his father's voice anymore. So like missing some of the comments that he made at the restaurant when he was still a little boy, like I was just thinking, gosh, kid, you're lucky you can't hear this shit because this is like classic alcoholic bullshit.
Yeah. And so, and then Eli Sunday shows up. And then I don't know. So how do you feel about the ending? How do you feel about his interaction with Eli Sunday?
Well, I think I'm most interested in thinking of it as a byproduct of him, you know, expelling his son. Like I feel like, you know, he wouldn't kill Eli if he hadn't just done that thing to his son. So in some ways he's murdering, you know, HW here. Or at least his connection to him. You know, he's proving to himself, you know, how invulnerable he is and how indifferent he is to his relationships to other people. I feel like that's the psychological setup that makes this scene possible, aside from, you know, how ill he is with his, you know, alcoholism and clearly how unsatisfied he is with his wealth. But man, the sadistic pleasure of of going along with the charade that he's going to make this deal, and then the whole, you know, the milkshake and the drainage thing feels very interesting to me as an explanation of the way he uses people, you know, like his son was just the milkshake that he just finished drinking. You know, that's the kind of self-awareness that Daniel has about himself, but that doesn't mean he doesn't hate himself on top of it. And that makes him violent. And, I don't believe him that he's finished.
You see, I have a different reading. I think he is finished. And I think what he wants to do first, though, is I think he has a genuine rage against God. I think he has. And so whereas Barry Egan is a character that I can really connect with, and I can see myself at different times in my life in the Barry Egan character, I see none of myself in Daniel Plainview. I think I know some people that are a little bit like him, but it's just not. It's been so long since I've felt alienation towards my fellow man that I just really can't understand this guy's motivation. Yeah. With that being said, the way that I've read that ending is that this is a guy who hates God. He has seen enough of life. I don't know if it's because he doesn't want there to be anybody that has something more than him, that he wants to be God in some way, or if it's just that he's so enraged at just the world that he hates God, and this is his way of finally just saying, like, God isn't real, is to convince this guy, Eli Sunday, to say he's not real and then to kill him. I do. I think it's him saying, you know what, screw it, I'm done. Before I'm done, I'm going to, you know, let's finish off the one little piece of unfinished business I have with the big man upstairs. And
so you think he must, in that view, he believes in God.
I think.
Interesting.
I'm not sure if he believes in God, but I think he's not as convinced as he wants to be that God doesn't exist. I think that's more of what it is. I think he's curious, and I think he's angry at the idea that there could be, and this is his final vengeance. I do see him a little bit as a Lucifer character, like from Paradise Lost. The first thing that he asked Paul Sunday, not the first thing, but one of the first things he says, is there any sulfur there? And Paul Sunday's response is, I don't know anything about sulfur. And so that cherubic version of Paul Dano, I think Daniel Plainview has the opposite. I think he has a satanic, I think he wants the sulfur. He wants the brimstone. And the way he shot and depicted at times, I think it's no question. Oh, and at the beginning, he has a fall. Like, he has a capital F fall. Like, yeah. Lucifer has a fall.
No, that's interesting.
As he falls into the silver mine. So, yeah, I think I view this at the end as his own way. It's almost impotent rage that he has. Like, why on earth would you kill Eli Sunday? There's no reason to kill this guy other than the fact that Paul Dano has a punchable face. There's just no reason to kill him. It's impotent rage because he knows he can't. He doesn't know if God exists, and if he does exist, he can't kill him. And so this is his little petulant, you know, version of vengeance. And then I think at that point he's like, screw it, I'm done. Whatever, I give up. Call the cops. Send me away to jail. I don't care.
I mean, if it's not tied to what has just happened with his son, then I guess it's just a crime of opportunity because, you know, he's won. He has nothing to prove to Eli Sunday anymore. I mean, there was a time when, you know, God was a better, religion was a better scam than the one he was selling, you right. know, like that works on people better than the thing that I'm selling. You know, I'm selling temporary, you know, gains, whether that's, you know, crops or food or education or, you know, it's temporary what I'm offering these people. God is forever, you know, so it's a better scam. That must have been frustrating. But at this point, like, what does he have? Like, he's clearly won, you know, Eli's telling him as much, like, look, I've fallen victim to, you know, to my own cravings in all these various ways. Like, you know, he knows what he's doing there. He's trying to manipulate Daniel by, you know, confessing, even real or not. But I don't know. See, you think he still has all that rage towards Eli from before, and he just takes that out of him because he's there?
Yeah, I do. I think it's like a biblical rage. I do. I think Daniel Plainview is so much more Old Testament than he is New Testament. I think this is just a guy who's ready to rain down hellfire. And when he's past the point of winning, when the earth is his, it's not enough. He still needs more. And it's one hell of a swan song. It's one hell of a coda.
So you think he's finished? What does that mean to you then? What, he's finished, and then therefore what?
I think on some level he knows that he's won everything from this life that he's going to win, and he's actually more bitter than ever. I think he knows he's, you know, a deranged alcoholic who's probably physically on the way out, even if he isn't. Who's probably physically on the way out anyways. And I think he's getting a sense of all this. And I think at this point he's sort of like, oh man, I really, I've violated all the laws I could violate. Like, I've done all the things I could do. I'm done. Like, this is it. I've won all the games. I've killed all the people. There's nothing left for me to do but to just, you know, to, I don't know, go to jail, to give up, to kill himself. I think he truly is finished at the end of the movie.
Well, do you at least think that if that's the case, part of what makes it feel so final is the scene with his son?
Oh, no question. No question. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think it is. I think it is all tied up. His misanthropic, as well as, I don't know if there's a word that means, you know, you hate God or whatever. But yeah, all these feelings are built up. And I think he broke his own heart when he pushed away his son. And then this is the final little outburst of rage. This is the final gusher.
Yeah, I mean, that is the difference between Daniel Plainview and Barry Egan. Barry Egan says, you know, if you don't give me the fucking phone number, I'm going to fucking kill you. Barry's just having a tantrum. Daniel will actually kill his sister.
Oh, man, it's insane. So, is there anything more we want to say about There Will Be Blood? I love this movie, and the main thing I got from rewatching all of Paul Thomas Anderson's films is a reevaluation and a rediscovery of There Will Be Blood for me. I love this movie, and I'm so happy I got to rewatch it.
Me too. Me too.
So let's talk about The Master. This is a movie I feel like you're probably better positioned to discuss and to tell me and to try to sell me a little bit on why I should like this movie more than I do. So tell me a little bit about your experience with The Master and your take on it.
Well, I didn't think that Barry Egan was going to be such a useful piece of connective tissue today, but you know, I know that you've got your reservations about this film, and I can only imagine that maybe some of your reservations are about Freddie Quell, and I would say that there are some surprising similarities between Freddie and Barry. I mean, you can see, you know, that they both have like uncontrolled violent outbursts. You know, they're both a little self-blind. There's something animalistic about Barry Egan, and maybe that's part of what we were talking about before that we could relate to. That's kind of exaggerated in Freddie. You know, it's a different decade. He has a different history. This is 1950. He's just come back from World War II. There is something odd about this man, something incomplete, something sort of like impossible to complete about Freddie.
Would you say there's something aberrated about him?
I might, but then I'd have to be like, what does that mean? Freddie is aware of his incompleteness. It's part of why he's so restless. You know, again, another character from another film, that the daughter of that rich guy in Inherent Vice says, I'm real good at escaping. Well, so is Freddie. Freddie is real good at escaping. It's practically his occupation. You know, he's also an alcoholic. He spends a lot of time creating, but what he creates are these very bizarre admixtures of chemicals that will get you high. And he apparently never makes them the same. Like, he really, I think, does think of that as a creative act. But the escape involved is, of course, the end zone that he's heading towards at all times. He's physically always on the run. He, you know, finds the possibility for love and he runs from it. He finds the possibility of employment and runs from it. He finally runs into a man who seems to be centered, grounded, and accepting of him. And, you know, I'm a little reticent to to accept the homosexual reading of this film, because I feel like that's a distraction from at least what I get from their relationship. But I do believe that they're in love.
But I agree with you. It's not. It's so besides the point if they have whether they have a homoerotic relationship or just a really tight friendship matters nothing to me. I completely agree with you.
Yeah. And that's exactly well put, because I feel like that mostly what's wrong with that is it derails from the things that I find interesting about their connection, which is deep and profound. And like you said, may or may not include homosexual interest. It doesn't matter. The way that they complete each other is what's ultimately fascinating and is the driving force of this film. It is unlike Inherent Vice, which is very plot heavy. This is a character story. It is mostly a character portrait of these two men. And it certainly has a fascinating backdrop. But I'm similarly not that interested in, and this not to dissuade you, if you want to talk about that, that's totally cool. The comparison between The Cause and Scientology.
I completely agree. That's the second. Yeah. Jordan, you're so on the same page as me. Those are, for a movie that I was excited to watch this movie because I wanted to see a takedown of Scientology, and it wasn't what this movie was at all. And now that I've seen it again, it does, like, I don't think about Scientology the entire time I watch this film.
Right. Because it's just a way of setting up a man who thinks that he can offer truth to people. And that's as far as its narrative value is important. I don't want to learn more about Scientology in an effort to maybe unpack more about this film. I'm sure Paul Thomas Anderson did do more research than shows up on the screen, but what he's come up with is, I just think, a really evolved articulation of what it means to be someone who is trying to offer other people answers that you don't have yourself. There's a great Altman quote that I think, what is that film Altman made with Philip Baker Hall about Nixon?
Oh gosh, was it The Secret History or Secret War? I've never actually seen it, but it's basically just Philip Baker Hall speaking into a microphone, right? And doing recordings.
Yeah, it's like a film play is really
what
it is.
Yeah, it's like a one man.
So on the commentary track for that film, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the title. Altman says that, I'm a paraphrase, but that art reveals what even the artist doesn't know, that that's what it should do.
Yep.
And so I feel like, Lancaster Dodd, which is Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, which is the man that Freddie Quell ultimately runs into after escaping a series of various other events, so the last of which, maybe he poisoned some guy with his chemical admixture. Maybe he didn't. I don't think he meant to. And he arrives on the boat and here's this guy, and he is the leader of this, again, possible comparison to Scientology group of people called The Cause. He's written a textbook that serves as the handbook for The Cause. He has come up with the various rituals that define, how one achieves enlightenment through The Cause, which is a kind of self-exploration, including the possibility of discovering what your past lives were, so that humanity can reach balance and prosperity in the current life. It on its face has very virtuous goals. The problem is he doesn't really know these things. And through the course of the film, we discover everyone around him, not everyone, but many people, including himself, starting to feel that tension of, no, there's not a lot of certainty involved here. There's mostly leap of faith. But I think some of the processing questions and some of the activities, especially coming from a performance background where, some of the things you do in acting classes, aren't that dissimilar. and they can be very revelatory, that there is some overlap between some of the exercises in this film, acting exercises and psychotherapy. There is a lot of overlap there. So I feel like, just like with psychotherapy, the more you give to these questions, the more they will answer for you. The problem is, no one is saying that there is a master behind it all who is really the authority to help you achieve these revelations. And I think that's what Freddie loves about this man is he believes in his, like, he's against authority figures. Like, clearly Freddie has a problem with authority figures, but somehow this man, he believes that he knows things that he could never know. And I think he really believes, one of the things he really believes is that this man doesn't have a problem with him and that he takes him for what he is, that all of his animalistic, chaotic tendencies don't threaten this person, that that's okay. And that feeling of okayness is what I think Freddie gets attached to. And we will eventually see Freddie and Lancaster Dodd part ways. But I think why that happens is Freddie loses faith, despite, you know, Lancaster Dodd's wife, Peggy, accusing Freddie of being not a believer, not committed, like maybe a spy. At a certain point, Freddie's the most committed, in my mind, the the best believer Lancaster Dodd has, and Lancaster Dodd knows it.
Right.
You know, if no one else is propping him up as a quasi God figure, you always have Freddie, you know. So when they eventually part ways, I think it's because Freddie can't see him as a God anymore. He sees him as a man, which is the first, one of the first things, you know, I parodied it at the beginning of part one. Lancaster Dodd lists all the various things that he is, nuclear physicist, etc. But above all, I'm a man. Well, that was a lie. You know, Lancaster Dodd is a liar. He lies for a living because he feels like he has to. So when Freddie sees him as a man, or other people see him as just a man, that's when he can't be around them anymore. You know, that's when he can't love them anymore.
So I think we should probably get back to World War II at some point. But I think the first thing I want to say is I feel like the relationship between the two of them is almost, I don't even really view them as two separate people. To some extent, I do view them as like two sides of the same coin in a couple of different ways. One, the master and the servant. I think there is definitely, or the general and lieutenant. I think, in fact, there's a deleted scene where, and I just saw this for the first time, where Freddie is given a jacket as the lieutenant, the first lieutenant of the cause. And I didn't realize to what extent he was the number two in the organization until I saw that scene, and then it sort of clicked for me. Like, Freddie is genuinely loved and genuinely appreciated by Lancaster Dodd and is, you know, is the number two in the organization in some ways. But I also think when you listen to Lancaster Dodd's tapes, or when you listen to him talk and some of the readings from his book, he says over and over again, you know, man is not an animal. Mm-hmm. And what's ironic is Freddie Quell is an animal. And he's not an animal because he's permanently disfigured, but I think temporarily his experiences in the war have made him very animalistic, and so there'll often be these ironic sound bridges or something where you'll hear Lancaster Dodd talking over visions or flashbacks of Freddie Quell, and it will be Lancaster Dodd saying "man is not an animal," and then you'll see Freddie Quell humping a sand. A castle version of a woman, and you realize he is very much an animal. And I think there's a connection, and Lancaster Dodd is always saying we met somewhere before. I think in some way they're the animal and the human. They're the two different sides of the same personality, as well as being the leader and the follower.
I think he sees himself in Freddie. I think, you know, I think that he relates to that animal that Freddie is. I think he thinks that's pure and honest and real, whereas what he's trying to do is come up with this rarefied version of what a human being is. I think he suspects, no matter how many times he insists, man is not an animal. I think he thinks that's not true.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that, you know, the only pure, real thing in his life is Freddie. Freddie is exactly what he presents himself as. He's not a phony. Who else, Dodd especially, who else in that circle can say the same?
Mm. And so connecting, so what I've heard what I've heard PTA say about this movie is essentially after periods of major change, that's when these spiritual movements tend to pop up, right? And yeah. So the idea that after World War II, for instance, that you'd have all these people coming home and they might have PTSD, or even just regular people in the world reading the news every day for year after year, you know, Pearl Harbor happens, all of these battles happen where tens of thousands of men are killed in a day. And so all this stuff is going on and your worldview is flipped upside down and maybe you feel a little bit crazy. Maybe you are actually crazy for a bit. And yeah. That's when people start looking outside themselves for more answers. And so that happens here. I think there's also clearly a parallel to the Paul Dano, to the Eli Sunday character in the Church of the Third Revelation in There Will Be Blood. And so I think what you see at the beginning of this movie is you see a man who has been, the world has really, he's been ruined a little bit from World War II, from his experiences. I think he admits at one point that he's killed some people. And on top of that, he's been drinking jet fuel. He's been drinking ethanol out of missiles.
And chemicals used in like photography. I mean, all sorts of shit.
Oh man. And so I think this is one of those moments where the world is totally in flux. They're free. They've been freed from the war, but they're not totally free. And so people are still trying to figure out their way in the world. And, you know, Lancaster Dodd is a guy who he's still searching for his way, but in a way he's also selling to other people that he knows the way. And I think that that's what you have here. And it's a very interesting, it's an interesting way to depict belief that he does here. And I think it is an interesting juxtaposition to the belief that we see in There Will Be Blood.
Oh, completely. I mean, you know, you talk about that urgency to find a belief system, you know, after periods of trauma, but also, you know, periods of trauma, as world upsetting as they can be, in creating a new paradigm, they also just create different needs. Like, you know, when he first boards that ship or wakes up, when Freddie Quayle first wakes up on that ship, the first thing that one of the women tell him is that you're safe, you're at sea.
Right.
Now, he fought the war at sea. You know, when something rewires you, it's not just, my understanding is it's not just trauma in that you need to avoid it. It's that push and pull relationship with that you need that paradigm, that has created in you a need for the circumstances that traumatized you. So, you know, why would it be if being at war was, you know, nothing but horror for Freddie, why would he enjoy being on a boat again? You know, there's this camera in this film enjoys the sea in a way that mirrors my own. I've never seen the ocean look so glorious. I don't think there's a single shot in all of cinema that I enjoy more than that blue wake of the boat that we return to. So I think it's the first shot of the film and it shows up a couple more times. I mean, if I could watch 1 second from one film and that's it ever again, it would be that shot.
And the way that this movie is successful for me is that I like Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman so much in this film. And this film to me, besides the beautiful cinematography, is successful in that it is a showcase for those two, like, giants of acting. I don't think it's hyperbolic to describe them that way.
No.
Where this movie falls down for me, the description I've heard of his process for preparing for this film is tipping my hat a little bit, or showing my hand a little bit. He said he had a bunch of scenes in mind. He didn't really have the full, like a full storyline or a full arc. And he had, when he was preparing for this movie, he just had all these scenes and he, you know, was expecting they would all come together. For me, they don't come together. And at least on this second viewing, because I think I've only seen this movie twice, it still doesn't feel like, I don't know, maybe I'm looking for catharsis too much, or maybe I'm looking for a specific version of the hero's journey that I'm not getting here, but the fact that it's a bunch of, it feels like a bunch of great scenes with great acting put together, and it just doesn't work for me. What is your response when you hear me say that?
I guess, God, I find that depressing. because you know, I would love for you to love it the way that I do, just because, you know, I think we see a lot of the other films that he's made in pretty comparable ways. So I guess I'm searching for, what is it about this one that I find the most transporting and that you find the least transporting? Because I can certainly, I understand what you mean when you see a series of scenes that maybe somehow don't quite add up to something concrete, is what I'm hearing. That maybe is one of its virtues to me, that mindset of being on the run, of searching for the answers that will make your life make sense to you, of searching for the people to surround yourself with that will make you feel okay. You know, that yearning, that and that intense lostness that, again, we see on exhibit on the surface in Inherent Vice. Like, I think we were discussing like the way in which that thing seems so convoluted. I think we argued is it's part of the way that film expresses lostness. I think in this film, lostness is buried deeper, but it's the same expression of just, you know, you want catharsis with this film. Well, these characters want catharsis with each other and with their environment, you know, but they can't get there. And I feel that so intensely when I'm with them and when I see them with each other.
Yeah. You know, Jordan, you may have just unlocked something for me. So the problem that I have with this movie, and maybe what you're saying is I need to be looking at this differently. The problem I have with this movie is I feel like Freddie Quell does when he's going back and forth in the room, bashing against the walls when I watch this movie. You know that scene where they're doing, what do they call it? I can't remember what he describes it as.
When he says, I feel a fucking wall.
Yeah. And he doesn't, application. Thank you. That's what he calls it. He calls it, Lancaster Dodd says the application is finished. I feel like Freddie Quell when he's frustrated going back and forth against the wall during the application, where I feel like this is just a bunch of scenes put together. Like I can't escape from that. Whereas I think maybe what you're saying is that's really all that this is. And I think what he's saying here is you're supposed to like understand that that's all that this is. And all of the characters are going through the same thing. They're all going through the application in some way. And that's sort of the incompleteness of life in general. And so this is like a really beautiful depiction of that.
Yeah. And it's possible that this is a meta commentary on that process of watching this film, and it's possible that it's not. But for our purposes, you know, when Dodd and Freddie are I don't know what I call Lancaster Dodd by his last name and Freddie by his first. Well, that's because Dodd is the master; it's respectful.
Yep.
So when they're doing that processing scene, I think with Clark, and Freddie is still a believer, right? But he's experiencing that frustration you're talking about, and Dodd says it's a hard, slow process, and Freddie says, I just don't understand it. And Dodd says, I don't either. Right. That's why we're here.
Right.
You know, and so the way in which some of these exercises are incomprehensible, and the way in which maybe some parts of this movie feel like hard to grapple with, like it's that grappling with, it's that searching for that is the point of the film as an audience member and for its characters. I it feels very complete to me in that way. You know, it feels... Yeah, it feels like an art installation at times, you know, and I mean that in completely in the most praising of ways. Right. I love art installations, but there is a certain way in which just letting it exist in front of you is very fulfilling to me.
And so perhaps the way that I should be viewing this movie is, and it kind of makes sense that we would put this last in our discussion if we view it in this way, is that, you know, PTA is so in control. He's such a master. when he does Punch Drunk Love, every single note of every instrument, every shot, every word, the blocking, everything about the color palette is so controlled in that movie. And then you get a different kind of control, but control nonetheless in There Will Be Blood. But I think perhaps if I view this as a deconstruction of a movie of PTA saying we're doing it a totally different way, I'm going to totally deconstruct everybody's expectations on what mastery over a movie should be. If I view the movie in that way, maybe that's a different way into it for me. So I don't know. Maybe the third viewing will be the game changer for me, Jordan. I don't know.
I hope so, man. If not, then you know, you're just the bravest boy I've ever met.
I'm gonna go through life without a master. Absolutely. So, is there anything else we should say about the master before we wrap up with our we're gonna pick our PTA rankings of his films? No. Is there anything we want to say about the master before we do that?
No, I think this will blend in pretty nicely to that list.
So why don't you go through your list first?
I was hoping you'd say that. Yeah, because my number one is The Master.
Yes.
You know, it is my favorite PTA film. I find it to be so cathartic and so revelatory just about what you can achieve on film. You know, you talk about those performances and, you know, at the time I thought Philip Seymour Hoffman was the best living actor and he's not with us anymore.
I think a lot of people, it was between him and Daniel Day when this movie came out. I think you're absolutely right. I think a lot of people viewed them as like the two titans.
And I have transferred that, you know, silly notion to Joaquin Phoenix. And I think, you know, standing back, he does give the more mind-blowing performance of the two in this film. And maybe it was designed to showcase him in a better way. But, I mean, I believe every breath he takes. You know, every gesture, you know, I don't understand some of the comments people make, like, oh, well, he was just loaded and who knows if he didn't even know what decisions he was making. Bullshit. Like, people perform loaded all the time. They don't do this. You know, this is an astounding transformation. Like, just if you have any doubts, just like briefly compare it to what he's doing in Inherent Vice, or like you brought up Walk the Line earlier, like, or Gladiator or whatever else. Like, he is a different person. He inhabits the body and soul of that man and in a way that I find incredibly moving. As animalistic as that man is, he's so dimensional to me. the way he says that one line, you mean like jealousy?
Do you feel envy?
Yeah, and he's like, oh, no, I don't think so. Oh, you mean like jealousy? It's so funny because it feels so real to me, despite how, you know, obviously, like, heightened this processing conversation is. The writing, I mean, you know, who can argue with the way that dialogue is written and executed? We talked about the visuals a little bit. I think it's, Robert Elswit, like, what a master cinematographer. This was not shot by him. And maybe it's also an aspect of that 70 millimeter that it was shot on. But this is his best looking film to me, as far as I'm concerned as well. It's not hands down because my number two is close number two, but this is number one.
And I'm guessing your number two is Magnolia. Is that correct?
You got it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I have undying love for that. We talked about it for a long time. You know, what a symphony. That movie is like a symphony of kaleidoscopic parts. And a really great exploration of desperation, in a different way than The Master is. And then my third one would be, I struggled with it. I mean, who doesn't struggle with lists? They seem arbitrary on some level. Boogie Nights, I think, might be my number three.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, you know, for a lot of the same reasons that Magnolia is definitely my number two, Boogie Nights achieves many of those things in a similarly impressive way. I would just give the edge to Magnolia. But the way that it handles a cast like that and the interweaving of all of those different plots and histories. I think it takes a real talent to, you know, have that many characters and have them all feel like they're fully fleshed out. Mm. You know, I'm sure an argument can be made that, you know, this person in this scene only shows up 1 second. What do you know about them? But you know, anybody who has even a couple lines of dialogue, there is the sense of history. And that's really hard to do. You know, there's many films that just, you feel like, oh God, how many characters is this film going to give me? And, you know, that sense of exhaustion is because you feel like what you're getting is shorthand. You're not getting people, you know, you're getting plot devices. Paul Thomas Anderson doesn't do plot devices as characters. They are always like, feel, you know, not central to the story, but they feel central to the environment that the story takes place in. So number four would be Punch Drunk Love. You know, you've said a lot of like really great things about, what you like about it. And I love this notion that it is a musical without music, which is probably my favorite kind of musical. it's a great humanist love story. It's simple. It's true. Number five would be There Will Be Blood. You know, for all of its mythic grandeur and portrait of narcissism, and Inherent Vice would be number six. Because that film, with all of my sort of struggles to like navigate through the plot to get to the stuff that I really like about it, it's a really impressive film, and I've never seen anything like it. And how many fucking films can you say that about?
Right.
Even though it's near the bottom of the list, like it's PTA. All his films, I think, as you said, you know, are masterpieces. They are. And then I just put Heart 8 at the bottom just because, you know, it's a great film. I've only seen it once, so my recollection of it is a little foggier. But it doesn't, you know, as first films often don't, like, it's not as mature an effort, but it's a good film.
So Heart 8 is available now on Amazon Prime, and there's lots of talk about it eventually coming out as a Criterion Collection disc. So I think we're all going to get an opportunity to revisit Heart 8 in the near future.
I hope so, because, you know, there's the print that he sent to Cannes that was chopped up by the producers, that I'm wondering if there's going to be more information or alternate cuts that would, like, show us what, you know, it's called by two titles because Paul Thomas Anderson wanted it to be called Sydney. So I hope there's a Sydney cut of some kind or more information about what that film used to look like.
Well, PTA is definitely involved with the Criterion release, so yeah, maybe that's going to be what's going to happen. It's going to be the Cannes cut. So one thing I'll say before I give my list is PTA drives me nuts in one particular way. He doesn't do commentaries on his discs, yet he claims that his film school was watching DVDs and listening to the commentary tracks. And that drives me up a wall, because I definitely appreciate a good commentary track, particularly anything that gives me insight into how the movie was made. I just love it. And the fact that, well, you know, one of the guys that seems to just pull off miracle after miracle claims that he learned how to do it via commentary tracks and yet won't return the favor. That is,
well, you know, there's barely a photograph of Thomas Pynchon, so I guess we should just be grateful we know what he looks like.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, so my PTA preference, my PTA rankings go like this. I put There Will Be Blood at the top, and this is a major change from this rewatching. This is a revelation. This is a revision of my rankings. I historically always had my number two, the number two I'm going to get to in a second, as my number one, and There Will Be Blood is like at the very bottom. But as I rewatch it now, I don't know if it's as I've gotten older or I have like a greater appreciation for, I don't know, for Old Testament themes and movies or what it is about my watching it now, but it absolutely blew me away. I cannot wait until I get a chance to see this again in the movie theater. Punch Drunk Love is my number two, and as I said previously, that had been my number one. I think it's a pure technical masterpiece. Like, I can't, it would take me a long time to think up something that I would change about the movie. Or that I would try to, that could be improved. I think it takes very mundane components of a man's life and forms it into this amazing musical love story. Alfred Hitchcock described movies as machines that create emotions. This is a machine that creates happiness for me. And, you know, yeah, I think it's a perfect movie. I love it. So number three is Magnolia. And, I mean, this movie makes me cry every single time I see it. And like I said, that's an impressive success. When you know what's coming around the corner and it still you know, evokes powerful emotion, that's success. Four, and this is a, I really like Inherent Vice. I think Inherent Vice is one of the funniest movies. And another revision that I have had is revising my opinion of Joaquin Phoenix as an actor in his two Paul Thomas Anderson roles in this, as well as The Master. I used to think he was a detraction, and that was just me being ignorant. Now that I rewatch it, yeah, he mumbles, but it doesn't matter. His performances are so amazing. They are like body and soul in these characters that it's, and I think he's great in here. And I think he has great comedic timing. Any scene where Josh Brolin is present is just comic gold. So I'm a big fan of Inherent Vice. Now I'm going to make a revision based off of our discussion. I'm going to bump up The Master because I think the character of Freddie Quell in particular is such a captivating character that I think I need to give the movie more credit than I previously had it as the very last movie, and I don't think that's accurate. And I'm willing to bet that the next time I watch it, it may grow in my estimation. Philip Seymour Hoffman, just gone too soon.
It's awful.
Yeah. Then I put Boogie Nights, and last is Heart 8. And Boogie Nights and Heart 8 are just movies I have to rewatch. This is a guy who I think it's safe to say, with the exception of Heart 8, has made a classic film. Even the movies that I don't necessarily like The Master, for instance, I don't know that I necessarily like love that movie. I recognize that it is a complete success in a way. And how many other filmmakers can you think of where they just bat 1,000? It's an impressive career, and Paul Thomas Anderson, he's a master.
Hell yeah. I'll thank you for inviting me on to do this with you. I thought it was a real privilege to watch these films and talk about them with you. It was totally enlightening. So thanks for all your thoughts and your time. This was a blast. And I'll leave us with one more quote from The Master. We fought against the day and we won.
Jordan, thank you.